Was the Bashar al-Assad government responsible for the chemical agent deaths affecting dozens in Khan Sheikhoun on April 4th? How significantly has the U.S. cruise missile strike authorized by President Trump changed the prospects for peace in Syria? How did the neocons successfully maneuver the removal of Mike Flynn and the alteration of Trump's policy towards Syria? Why has the Western world recently ignored one of the most tragic humanitarian disasters in the history of the six-year-old Syrian conflict? What is to be made of Turkey's shifting alliances and its recent attack on Kurdish positions inside Syria and Iraq? This week on the Global Research News Hour, we review some of the news coming out of Syria, beginning with the April 4th chemical agent deaths attributed to President Assad, and evaluate the prospects for peace in the beleaguered country and the region. We'll speak with retired CIA analyst Ray McGovern, we'll hear reports from Patrick Henningsen of 21st Century Wire, and we'll get some thoughts from geopolitical analyst Mahdi Nazemroya. On this week's program, escalation of tensions in Syria, 1 month after the chemical attack in Khan Sheikhoun. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of April 28th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. A statement from the Turkish military justified the strikes on a long-grounded and orthodox basis that the groups in question had links with the Kurdish Workers' Party, or PKK, deemed by both Washington and Ankara as a terrorist group. The fighters in question had become targets as a preventative measure against the smuggling of weapons and munitions into Turkey that might end up being used by the PKK against the Turkish state. The agenda for liberation has no borders. Quote, "To destroy these terror hubs, which threaten the security, unity, and integrity of our country and our nation, and as part of our rights based on international law, airstrikes have been carried out, and terrorist targets have been struck with success." Unquote. The PKK presence in Sinjar was yet another consequence of violence and its bitter fruit, a response to the murderous efforts of Islamic State militants against the local Yazidi population that saw genocide and enslavement practiced against thousands. That comes from the article, "Turkey's Kurdish Agenda" by Dr. Binoy Kampmark, posted April 27th. On April 24th, Fars News reported increased U.S.-UK Israeli aid to al-Nusra terrorists, aiming, quote, "to create an autonomous region in southern Syria, but the plan is confronted by Iran and Russia's intensified intelligence and military operations," unquote. At the same time, Washington supports Kurdish fighters and terrorist groups in northern Syria, quote, "Israel is providing logistical intelligence and medical support for terrorist groups, and the Israel West Jordan Operations Room is supervising their activities," unquote. Russia, Damascus, and Tehran oppose the establishment of autonomous regions in southern and northern Syria, supporting the country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. On April 24th, the American Herald Tribune said, quote, "Ya'alon has admitted to a tacit Israeli alliance with ISIS," unquote. That comes from the article, "Alliance of Convenience, Israel Supports Syria's ISIS Terror Group," by Stephen Lendman, posted April 27th. On April 25th, the Turkish Air Force bombed the Kurdish People's Protection Units, or YPG, General Command HQ, in the Mount Karachok near the town of Al-Malakia, according to a statement released by the YPG General Command. Airstrikes also hit, quote, "a media center, a local radio station, Voice of Rojava FM, communication headquarters, and some military institutions, unquote. The YPG Central Command also confirmed casualties among YPG members and civilians. According to pro-Kurdish sources, about 20 persons were killed in the airstrikes. The YPG is a core of the U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces operating in Syria. That comes from the article under the headline, Video, Turkey Bombing U.S.-Backed Forces in Syria, Israel Supports ISIS, by South Front, posted April 27th. Turkey is a U.S. ally, and the U.S. has several bases in Turkey which it uses to fight the Islamic State. The U.S. is also allied and operates with the YPG in Syria and the Peshmerga of the Barzani clan in Iraq, the airspace in East Syria and northwest Iraq supposedly under U.S. control. There will be some serious explaining to do why the U.S. did not prevent one of its allies from bombing its other allies. Did it agree to this Turkish attack? That comes from the article, Turkish Airstrikes on Kurds Complicate U.S. Operations in Iraq and Syria, posted April 26th, originally appearing at Moon of Alabama. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. We're joined now by Ray McGovern. He is a former U.S. Army Infantry Intelligence Officer and a retired CIA analyst. He also serves on the Steering Committee for Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, a group of CIA veterans which was established in January of 2003 after concluding that Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld had ordered their colleagues to manufacture intelligence to justify an unnecessary war with Iraq. The group has put out two memos in the past month questioning the White House's actions and allegations in response to its stated suspicion of chemical weapons use by the Syrian military against the civilian population. Mr. McGovern, thank you very much for joining us.
You're most welcome, Michael.
Now, I wanted to just look at some of the, a bit of a retrospective now. I know that in the April 11th memo, dated April 11th, in item 2, it concludes the attack was from a Syrian airstrike on an ammunition depot in Al-Qaeda in Syria-controlled territory, and that it contained noxious chemicals which drifted over Khan Sheikhoun, as opposed to it being from a deliberate a chemical weapons attack from the Syrian military. Is that now confirmed? Do you have further details about what really happened there?
We do have further details, but you won't find them in the New York Times. In a word, what happened was this. We have an arrangement to deconflict air attacks over Syria. The people that we have this arrangement with are the Russians, the Syrians, the British, and the Turks. Oh, and the Iranians also sit on this, okay? So we have this system where we try to deconflict so that our aircraft don't run into each other, and we vet targets. And this target was vetted by the Russians. That is, the Russians told us in this secure telephone exchange that their Syrian friends were going to bomb this area in Idlib province, that there was some concern that this what appeared to be a weapons storage facility might have chemical weapons in it, because it was well known that the insurgents or the rebels, even the, quote, moderate ones, end quote, were working and had this kind of chemical capability. Two chemicals put together in a workshop can make sarin gas, for example. Not that I'm suggesting it was sarin gas used or that killed all those people on the 4th of April. What I'm saying here is this. Russians said Syrians are going to attack this facility. We're a little afraid that there are chemicals in there, but we don't think it's a problem. How about, what do you think? Now, the United States had at least a whole day. Normally it's 2 or 3 days to vet this information to look. And the U.S. came back and said, we think there are, might be some chemical weapons in there, but no problem. So what happened? The Syrian Air Force used a GPS-guided bomb, bombed this facility, and then watched as there was no secondary explosion. Rather, a large cloud, a large white cloud, arose from this facility, blew southward at a very stiff wind over this village where all those poor people were killed. Now, that's a far cry, a very far cry, from what the United States, the New York Times, and everybody else is saying, namely, Bashar al-Assad deliberately used a chemical bomb or missile on this little village. That's just as false as saying Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction or Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11. That started a war. Our concern is that most Americans believe the New York Times still. And so if the president decides that he needs to start a little dust up, even if it risks involvement with Russia, with Russian forces, that he's likely to do it. Major lesson we learned out of the whole thing, in my view, is that Trump is so unpredictable, so reckless, and his generals, he calls them his generals, are so loath to restrain him that he can, without any evidence of who was responsible for those terrible deaths in Syria, he can order his generals, oh, we got Tomahawk missiles? Order, why don't you fly maybe 60 of them, and they will salute and do it without any intelligence. There was no time for intelligence, and the intelligence they adduced 2 days later was a farce, and we know that. So this is very, very difficult and very, very precarious, because if I were Russian, I have Chinese, or I was a Korean, I would have my forces on high alert, given the recklessness of this president and the willingness of his chief mad dog generals to carry out his orders without putting any restraint on him.
Now, you mentioned just a minute ago about WMDs in Iraq and how that was clearly fraudulent, and that evokes the whole concept of shaping the intelligence around the policy. I mean, they were just looking for an excuse to go into to orchestrate what the Department of Defense had determined was going to happen. And I'm just kind of curious about the intricacies of intelligence and its relationship with the Defense Department, because they're supposed to be providing the facts. And I mean, are we seeing a situation where the intelligence people are somehow pressured into, like, is there some a level of self censorship, or they're just interpreting things really liberally so to get the kind of results that their people want, or are they deliberately manufacturing stuff under pressure? I mean, how exactly does that work in this environment?
Mm-hmm. Well, that is the question, of course. Now, part of the answer would lie in answering these questions. Why was there no intelligence assessment? Well, the answer to that is that there are still enough analysts at the CIA and elsewhere with integrity, and that the risk was that if the administration represented their, quote, findings, end quote, as an intelligence assessment, well, some of these honest analysts might just figure that that is, you know, here we go again, we're going to start a war based on faux intelligence, based on fraudulent intelligence. Please, your listeners need to know that the evidence that was adduced to justify, in quotes, the attack on Iraq was not a mistake. It was out and out fraud. So what we have here in this case is there's enough risk on the part of the the muckety-mucks, the head of the CIA and the generals, that it will not be restrained or restrain the commander-in-chief, there's enough fear that they'll blow the whistle and say, no, no, that's not an intelligence estimate. That was concocted by political hacks in the White House, because that's exactly what it was. So they don't even represent it as an intelligence assessment. Rather, H.R. McMaster, a general who's running the National Security Council, he just put out the blind. He didn't even say who produced the darn thing. And the thing, as I say, is an embarrassment. So in a larger context, the good news, well, the bad news first, okay? The bad news is that I watched my former colleagues before Iraq participate in a fraud on the American people. They manufactured evidence to give enough credence to Bush's allegations to start a war against Iraq, and we know the consequences of that now. Okay, that's the bad news. That's what's happening at the highest levels now. There's still, as I say, enough honest analysts to put the brakes on what they call it. Now, the good news is this. Integrity counts, okay? Now, if you got somebody in a position, as happened after the Iraq debacle, when it was very clear that Bush and Cheney had their sights set on Iran, okay? And the military didn't want any part of attacking Iran. It would have made attacking Iraq look like a volleyball game between Mount St. Ursula and the Ursuline Academy. You know, so anyhow, what happened was somebody said, hey, let's get an honest CIA estimate, and they did. They hired an assistant secretary of state from the State Department. His name is Tom Finger. He came in 2007, worked with honest analysts, and came up with the conclusion that Iran, get this now, you won't see it in the New York Times, that Iran stopped working on a nuclear weapon at the end of 2003 and had not resumed work on a nuclear weapon. Now, that was 2007. That was released to the press, and that played a huge role in preventing what would have been a debacle of a war. In other words, it prevented Bush from attacking Iran, which he and Cheney intended to do in their last year in office, 2008. And don't take McGovern's word for it. I don't suggest you buy the book, but go to the library and look at Bush's memoir, where he admits that that estimate deprived him of the military option, as he said. For how could I, this is a quote, how could I justify attacking a country that the intelligence community said had no active nuclear weapons program? Bummer, bummer. If they were really concerned about that, they would have called the Israelis and say, hey, guys, guess what? We found out that not only are they not working on nuclear weapons program, but they stopped doing that 4 years ago, 2003. Let's have a drink of wine here. No, they wanted to give Iran the next bloody nose. So the bottom line here, integrity counts. In that case, we had a completely honest manager. His name, again, was Tom Finger. He knew his way around Washington. He kept the whole estimate secret until the very end. And when it came out, he knew that it would either leak or the president would have to release it. He did. And a war was averted. So there is still the capability of honest analysts not only to whistleblow if needed, but to do the correct job if they have the appropriate leadership. Sadly, they lack that leadership now. No one has made a pipsqueak. No one has made any kind of objection to what's gone down here with the NSC political hacks being represented as intelligence analysts. So it doesn't look very good. We have a proven reckless president now who lashes out at the slightest slight, real or imagined. And we have a Russia, we have a Chinese, and we have Koreans, all with the potential to do irreparable harm to our allies and some of them to ourselves. So this is very labile, as the Germans would say. This is a very precarious situation. Problem is, Nobody seems to recognize it, and you won't find this in the New York Times.
I wanted to get one more comment from you. I mean, you were talking about honest analysts and, you know, I guess a sense of, you know, responsibility and integrity. Could you comment on the departure of Mike Flynn? Because he was definitely a factor in Obama's decision not to attack in August of 2013, given sort of similar indications or suggestions of chemical weapons use. You know, Mike Flynn seemed to be a critical factor there in them not going going ahead straight away, rushing into any kind of an attack. And now Mike Flynn is gone. I mean, is that a coincidence, or how exactly was his departure? Do you have any insights into the mechanisms by which he was eliminated from the discussion?
Yeah. The firing of Flynn was directly related to this witch hunt for people who talk to the Russians, who have been to Russia, or who talk to the Russian ambassador. The general objective was to prevent any improvement in U.S. relations with Russia. Why is that? Well, the simple answer is what Pope Francis called the blood-soaked arms traders need tension, above all tension with countries that they represent as the incarnate evil, okay, like Russia. So what happened here is that Trump and Flynn in particular were reaching out to the Russians. They were saying, look, you know, we don't see any reason why our relationship should fall into a state of complete disrepair. Let's start talking, see if there are mutual adjustments we can make. Now, this was exactly against what the so-called neocons, what the people who really want this tension, wanted. So what happened? Well, back in 2013, these same neocons were lusting after an overt U.S. role in war against Syria. Why? Well, because Bashar al-Assad was beginning to win. He had dislodged a lot of the rebels, immoderate and moderate rebels, from positions they had held for a couple of years before. He was winning. And the question was, well, how can we stop this? Now, Israel played a huge role in this. So did Saudi Arabia. So did Turkey. They were our, quote, our allies, end quote. And so they said, look, you know, let's plant some sarin in the rebel-held parts of Syria. Make believe that it was Bashar al-Assad that did it, and we'll be off and running. The U.S. will have to intervene because Obama was persuaded a year ago to put down a red line when he said that if Syria so much as it moves, much less uses the chemical weapons that they have, that's the red line for me. That's when I reassess my decision not to intervene militarily. Well, they almost succeeded in this mousetrap, but they failed at the last minute because Michael Flynn, the same Michael Flynn, who was head of the Defense Intelligence Agency at the time, would not participate in the charade. He told his boss, General Dempsey, head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, that it was the rebels. It wasn't Bashar al-Assad. Dempsey was also told the same thing by his British counterpart, and so he went to Obama on the evening of August 30th, 2013, and said, Mr. President, my information is that you're being mousetrapped here, that it was the rebels, that it was probably the people that we support, that is the CIA supports, that did this sarin attack. So you should know that if you're going to push the button for those French fighter bombers who are on the tarmac now to do their attacks, and you've warned the Israelis who have their defenses way up. You can push the button if you like, but when I'm asked 2 days from now, when the inspectors, the UN inspectors, come back from Baghdad, or not from Baghdad, but from Damascus, when I'm asked, you know, why couldn't you wait? Why couldn't you wait until you heard from the inspectors that were there on the scene? I'm going to have to say, Mr. President, beats the hell out of me, go ask the president. Now, you may recall that the very next day, August 31st, Obama got up to the Rose Garden and the White House and said, the chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff, my advisor, has told me that there's no need to do this attack right now, or next week, or next month, and so I've decided to go to Congress for permission for this. Whoa. Now, why all this business? That was preventing overt involvement of these Tomahawk missile-carrying ships in the eastern Mediterranean during September of 2013. It put the kibosh on the neocon plans to get involved in an overt war against Syria. And did Flynn make any friends by telling his boss telling the president that no, it wasn't Bashar al-Assad, it was John Brennan, the head of the CIA, who manufactured this mousetrap, okay? No. Most assuredly, he did not make any friends in that area. And so what do we have? Well, as soon as Flynn looks like he's going to be the national security advisor, actually, he is named the national security advisor. What does Brennan do? Well, there are intercepted conversations that are supposed to mask, supposed to delete American names. But Brennan gets access to that. And he leaks the information, Flynn over the Christmas vacation. You know who he's talking to? The Russian ambassador. My God, look at you. And that gets to the New York Times, and you get this witch hunt. And the significance of all this is that Trump and Pence blinked. This was the first overt attack on Trump's stated wish to reach out to Russia with what happened to Michael Flynn, rather than assuaging all these other people, they smelled blood, and just like a bunch of sharks, they put the kibosh on his outreach to Russia to the point of having it appear that he's so much a, quote, Russian puppet, end quote, that this was one of the factors that motivated Trump without any intelligence. There was no time for intelligence on this chemical event in Syria. Motivated Trump to get back in the good graces of the New York Times and launch these missile attacks to show how tough he was and show that he didn't give a rat's patootie about Russia. He was no puppet of Russia. Look what he just did. So these things have consequences. And we have an organization here called the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. We're composed of mostly retirees who, the expertise available to us is just won't quit, okay? And we also have young people on the ground in these areas who trust us, who know that we try to get the truth out there. And so they tell us things, and that's why I am able to tell you how this thing went down. When the president said Bashar al-Assad did a chemical attack on the Syrian people, I can tell you that's a lie. And I can tell you that the military officers that he calls his generals know it's a lie. Whether Trump knows it's a lie or not, I'm not really sure. What I think is he doesn't care. This was an opportunity to burnish his credentials as a tough guy, not to be messed with. That, my friends, is very, very dangerous.
Ray McGovern, I really want to thank you for providing us with these fascinating insights and for sharing your knowledge with us. We hope we can have you or another member of your group on again. Thanks for joining us.
Okay, you can go to raymcgovern.com for more.
Okay. Ray McGovern is a former U.S. Army intelligence and infantry officer and a retired CIA analyst and serves on the steering committee for Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. In addition to the chemical weapons incident earlier in April, there was, on April 15th, a devastating incident in which over 100 children were killed when a terrorist attack hit a bus convoy affecting the people being evacuated from villages near Aleppo. CFUV's Chris Cook of Guerrilla Radio managed to interview 21st Century Wire's Patrick Henningsen, who was on the scene hours after it happened. Here's the report that aired on April 19th.
Well, joining me now is Patrick Henningsen. Patrick is in Syria right now. How's it? Where are you, Patrick? Can you hear me, Patrick?
Yes, I can hear you.
Where are you right now?
We're in Damascus.
So tell me what's going on. You arrived there just after the bombings outside Aleppo. What's the mood in Syria right now, and is there any further developments?
There's a lot of developments, and we did visit the bombing site outside of Aleppo, Rashidin, and did some investigations, and that was broadcast live on RT International this evening, and the completely conflicting with the mainstream narrative, of course, which is, completely deceptive. And we're just finding that more and more. The reports about Syria, almost every major story, are completely fabricated. I've talked about that. We've all talked about that for years. And so this trip has validated pretty much everything that I ever suspected is actually validated so far. But security situation's very tense. There's still a lot of heavy fighting. We've been in fighting areas all over the country with airstrikes overhead.
Patrick, there's also news here that this whole gas attack that happened a couple weeks ago, or at least that allegedly happened, is also being drawn into court. Well, it's always been in question, but now Theodore Postol, the MIT professor, has released a big piece on this, taking this apart from using scientific method that makes it look like the whole gas attack that triggered Donald Trump's missile attack against Syria never even happened. Have you followed this?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, all you have to do is do a little scan of Twitter and see some of the images posted by the white helmets, and it quickly becomes clear that there was some staging involved in this, the creation of this event, plus the look at the aftermath of the so-called medical facilities, which are carved out of a cave. So it's well known that terrorists have dug tunnels and have their sort of triage underground in order to be safe from airstrikes and so forth. So, what are the white helmets doing in underground terrorist triage areas? And so they supplied the film for this event, and there's a lot of holes in it. It's completely improbable from a strategic point of view, not to mention the fact that chemical ordnances, if they were ever used, would be detonated above ground and not on impact. So it's just one after another. This is probably the biggest, to me, it's the biggest joke. It's the most long-running narrative. It just they seem to recycle it over and over, and the media are just none the wiser in this sort of chemical weapons WMD narrative. And I don't even know where to begin. It's so ridiculous to suggest that President Assad or the Syrian government would launch a chemical attack when they're winning the war with conventional weapons. It's kind of a joke even to suggest it, but there we go.
Well, it takes a lot of gymnastics, of course, because the Syrian government gave up its chemical weapons, and it was an internationally supervised event through the Russians a few years ago. But the Postol, Professor Postol, he does a very, what seems to me to be a pretty rudimentary examination of video that was provided as evidence of this attack from Syria and from so-called rebel groups. And, even a cursory examination of this by anybody familiar with video editing could tell you that these videos didn't add up. And Postol mentions that. I wonder why the people that make a living cutting video, like CNN or BBC or any of the major news outlets, failed to find this. Do you think that they're just not looking?
No, it's worse than that, Chris. They've been doing this since the beginning of this conflict. There's no forensic examination. There's no skepticism. There's no skeptical eye from any editors or any producers at any of these major networks like CNN, NBC, and so forth. They just take it from activists, and they take it from the White Helmets, and they run it. They don't even check to see when it was filmed. They don't really, they don't know where it was filmed. It could be filmed anywhere at any time, and it just appears on YouTube. And so that's as good as gospel for the mainstream media, because the videos that they're running, whether they're heavily edited or whatever, fit a certain narrative, which just so happens to streamline, dovetail with whatever's coming out of the U.S. State Department or the White House or the British Foreign Office or whatever. That's all that matters, is that it fits the narrative. And that, you know, is in line with whatever that policy du jour is, regime change, or whatever, you know, so, or the war on ISIS or whatever. So, and people here see right through it. People in the Middle East, well, for the most part anyway, in Syria, completely see through this. And they don't even watch as much international news as the average American does, but, people in North America and Europe who are glued to their televisions 24 hours a day, have no grasp of reality at all, whereas people here who watch less television seem to be able to spot fakery a lot quicker than the average Westerner. That's the world we live in, you know.
Well, it's like Danny Schechter.
Interesting.
Danny Schechter said years ago, the more you watch, and wrote a book about it, the more you watch, the less you know, referencing television media. We here on this side of the world, as you well know, Patrick, we get a pretty skewed view of what's going on within Syria. Like Milosevic or Saddam Hussein or any of the other Hitlers that we've seen the Western powers align against in the last couple decades, Assad is the next one. How is Assad regarded within the country? Are people afraid to say how much of a monster he is, or is it possible that he's not the monster that we're told he is?
Listen, I don't know where. Listen. Everywhere I've been, over half of the country so far. And I've spoken to many, many people, and it's not rehearsed. These aren't, you know, aren't people that are set up to come and talk to me. And overwhelmingly, everybody in this country supports the president. Overwhelmingly. I'm talking, if you had an election today, it would probably be in the 70 to 80 percentile. Okay. Find me a U.S. president that has that sort of mandate, please. I'd love to meet them. You know,
Well, Patrick, we don't have much time. Sorry to step on you there, Patrick. We don't have a lot of time left.
You know, they're behind. Yeah, they're behind this president, Chris, and they're behind this government, because that's the only thing that's fighting terrorism and fighting internationally backed, Western and Gulf backed, basically terrorists. There's no other way. They're not rebels. This is not a civil war. End of story. You know, factually. It's disingenuous to suggest that it's a civil war. It's a foreign invasion, foreign-backed invasion of extremist ideological terrorism, absolutely, 100%.
And now here is a follow-up report, which aired April 26th.
Well, Patrick Henningsen was here last week, too. Patrick is from 21st Century Wire. He's currently on the ground in Syria. He arrived there almost 2 weeks ago with Vanessa Bealey, just before the Al-Fua and Kafria refugees were being bombed. Their reports from the scene were subsequently broadcast around the world at 21 Wire and on the RT networks. Welcome back to the program, Patrick.
Hi, Chris. Good to be back.
Well, I want to know, Patrick, what's going on? What's the latest there on the ground?
With regards to the bus bombing, there's some of the children have been returned. They were taken apparently to Turkey, or in deepest Idlib, or maybe possibly to Turkey in Turkish ambulances, and they were somehow returned. So there must have been some international pressure to send some of these victims back. Some of them came back untreated. Some of those are getting treatment now in an actual hospital in Aleppo.
very shady incident, to say the least. And I think one of the motivations of it is statements by members of the UN saying that the Syrian government can't be trusted with the transfer of people, evacuees, etc., such important work. The UN needs to be in there doing it for them, etc., etc. So you can kind of see how the talking points are being formed in the wake of what looks to be a staged event, a very violently staged event, and no fingers being really pointed at the terrorists who carried out the bombing. It just all seems to be talking points, again, using this to demonize the Syrian government, etc. It seems to be par for the course with the so-called international community, and it's just, quite frankly, ridiculous.
Well, Media Lens, Patrick, has just published a big piece, and they cite, of course, Theodore Postol from MIT and his reports that the so-called gas attack in Syria that precipitated Donald Trump's, at least as the official narrative goes, his launching of the 59 missiles into Syria and other things as well, is calling into question the whole narrative, even though the media here is cleaving to this idea that there was a gas attack launched by the Assad government. What are you hearing about the further unraveling of that narrative?
All I can tell you is nobody here believes it. The only people that seem to have swallowed the chemical weapons plot story are people in the United States, North America, and Western Europe. No one else really believes it. And there's still no evidence to say it happened. There's been no forensic investigation, so apparently it's not important enough to investigate. You know, they already made up their mind what happened because they saw a White Helmets video on YouTube. This is how ridiculous this whole thing is. And this is like, by order of magnitude, more idiotic than the Iraq weapons of mass destruction. And meanwhile, the biggest tragedy of this whole conflict, one of the worst death days, was the Rashidine bus bombing of the evacuees of the villages of Fura and Kafueya. And those 100 and some odd children involved. And no outrage there. No one's changing, their Facebook profiles there. Donald Trump's not launching any Tomahawk missiles because of this. What is it? What is this? I think the Western public have been conditioned, like Pavlovian conditioning, to react, and the media to react with righteous indignation whenever someone mentions the word chemical weapons or sarin gas, and forget about even finding out if it's actually happened. This is where we're at in the West, total fantasy land. And I'm sorry to be cynical, Chris, but everything I've seen here on the ground in the last couple of weeks has led me to that conclusion. The West are in a total delusional fantasy land with regards to everything and anything about this country of Syria and the conflict going on here.
Well, I would argue, Patrick, that it's the cynicism is on the part of denying the truth of the situation. And you were walking around and you produced an extensive article called Aleppo, After Devastation, the Rehabilitation, Part 1, and with a lot of pictures, too, walking around and seeing the utter destruction after the result, the predictable enough results of more than 5 years of warfare.
Yeah, and also, I'm sitting there listening to, before I left, I was listening to Fareed Zakaria on CNN one Sunday morning, and he had some opposition activist from Aleppo, apparently some doctor as well, saying that ISIS were never in East Aleppo, saying the al-Nusra Front were never East Aleppo. And meanwhile, there I am 2 weeks later in the basement of an ISIS women's prison, which they fashioned out of an eye hospital in East Aleppo in a Sharia court with ISIS paraphernalia everywhere. And, unbelievable. So not only were they there, they had set up their own court and prison system. And we've, posted some of the pictures of it, So that's CNN. It's a multi-billion dollar global news network. And who are we? Well, we're just running around on a shoestring. And how come we can get the facts and CNN can't? How is that possible? You know, is it because they're not looking for the facts? You've already decided on their narrative, and they're still talking about these people like they're rebels. There's nothing. There are no rebels. They're dropping mortars right now in Damascus. You know, 10, 12 a day. I don't know how many a day. Randomly at civilians. How are these rebels? You know, ask any resident here. They just sit there and shrug their shoulders and laugh. Like, you know, what planet are the Western media on? You know, what universe are they inhabiting that they can interpret what's going on here with, you know, such, I don't even know what to say. It's just ridiculous. And they base the whole pretext of all their intervention, all their war on lies. It's quite simple.
Well, Patrick, how do people, our listeners, find out more about what's really going on there and more of the work that you and your colleagues are producing at 21st Century Wire?
Well, you go to 21stcenturywire.com, 21wire.tv, subscribe, become a member if you can. That helps us out. Check out our Facebook pages, Twitter pages, myself, Vanessa Beely on Twitter and Facebook, and watch, go to sana.tv, go look at Syrian television. It's much more factual than anything in the West. So, and RT, doing great reporting. I've seen their correspondents here. You know, they're on the ground doing actual reporting here. No one else is. You know, us and RT and a couple of others. So, you know, where should you go for the facts? Go for the people that are collecting your real information.
Over the past week, Turkey has been bombing Kurdish positions in Iraq and Syria. To get some perspective on the context of those attacks, we provide part of a discussion I had with Mahdi Nazemroya, which was recorded on April 1st. Mahdi, when you look at this, the Turkish situation, the standoff with the Kurds, affiliation with Russia, the membership in NATO, and at the same time, you've got tensions between Armenia and Azerbaijan, Azerbaijan being courted by NATO. So where does this, how does that picture, how do you situate Turkey within that picture and where it's going to be directing its efforts in the future?
Well, Turkey envisioned for itself, and the United States envisioned this for Turkey to an extent too, was that Turkey would play the role of a spoiler in the post-Soviet spaces, Central Asia and Caucasus regions. What I mean by spoiler is that the Turks would garnish their linguistic capital, their cultural capital there, any economic, socioeconomic links, political links in those regions, to the debasement or cost to Russia. Russia. After the Soviet Union broke up, there's a push for pan-Turkism, renewal of Turkic identity. First, Russia, to keep Russia out. I would say then Iran and China, to keep them out. This hasn't worked. You see Kazakhstan, very close to Russia. Azerbaijan, it did work in Azerbaijan, the Republic of Azerbaijan. You can even see from the Azerbaijani flag, it's modeled similarly to the Turkish flag. But today, the Azerbaijan of today under President Aliyev is not the same Azerbaijan as a decade and a half ago. It's not as close to NATO as it was. You can see from the trilateral meetings between President Rouhani, President Putin, and President Aliyev that Azerbaijan is being incorporated into something else, which is a Russian-Iranian project, and I would say by extension an Indian project. It's the North-South corridor. So the Chinese are doing the East-West corridor, which is the Silk Road, on land and the Maritime Silk Road. But the Russians, the Iranians, and the Indians are doing the North-South corridor, which is to incorporate India vis-a-vis the Persian Gulf, Iran, bypassing Pakistan to Central Asia, the Caucasus, and Europe. And Azerbaijan is pivotal to this because Azerbaijan is the state in between Europe, in between Russia and Iran. That's why there are many trilateral meetings at the level of border security, economic, railway, heads of railways, foreign ministers, deputy foreign ministers, and presidents between Azerbaijan, Russia, and Iran, because it's part of this. Credit lines have been given to Azerbaijan. They are linking up, integrating the energy grids. So this north-south corridor in the Caspian area, in the Caucasus, Azerbaijan's pivotal to it. I would say today, the Azerbaijan of today is more neutral than before. I mean, of course, it has good ties with Israel, the United States, which are rivals to Iran and Russia. But that doesn't mean that it's not looking out for its interests. I think it's an independent actor, and you can see that in the trilateral meetings. To an extent, Mongolia is the same thing. There are trilateral meetings at the level of China, Mongolia, Russia for this another north-south corridor through Mongolia. So you see integration throughout this entire landmass from Europe, from the Baltic, all the way down to the East China Sea, South China Sea. So we should keep that in mind. In regards to Turkey, also Turkey has shifted its position. The Turkish government is made up of many businessmen. I mean, they can see the center of gravity is in it's not in Washington, it's not in Brussels. Mm-hmm. You know, they see the writing on the wall. I mean, they have to do these ties, trade ties. There are nuances also. I mean, there are still complexities between Russia, China, Iran. For example, the truce you brought up, which I would add Kazakhstan is a fourth member, the venues in Kazakhstan. Iran did not sign that truce. It's only a guarantor of the truce. Russia and Turkey did. So there are differences where Russia and Iran have some differences on that issue with Turkey. There's things to be seen on that. But of course, the Turks are looking out for their interests. There's no question about that. You can see even the ties with the European Union are being affected because of the constitutional changes that involve Erdogan. He's concentrating more power in the presidency. The presidency was not an executive presidency before when he was prime minister. It was the prime minister who had power. Then what happened is he becomes president, and he's also, I'd like to point out, this is, I guess, trivia. The world's biggest palace for a head of state is Erdogan's presidential palace. It was actually built for the prime minister, but then when he becomes president, the designation is handed over to the president. But now that he's concentrating power, becoming more authoritarian, you know, there's problems with Europe, and it's not over issues of democracy. I think it's more complicated than that. You know, Turkish cabinet ministers were expelled from the Netherlands, for example, and from the European Union. So there is a shift in Turkey, but I don't know how far it'll go, but they do see the writing on the wall. I mean, that's why you're having countries like, not just Turkey, I mean, you're having all this debate within the European Union about their interests. For example, when the European Union sanctions Russia, it's sanctioning itself. Those are your energy supplies. I mean, that plays to the hand of the Americans. The Americans, they see the Russians as their biggest competitors for selling LNG, liquid natural gas. What do you do if you can't compete with cheaper Russian natural gas, which is territorially adjacent to the European Union? Maybe you encourage sanctions and you start selling your own. They're building a port in Poland, for example, to do those things. So, I mean, there's a lot of nuances there.
I want just before we leave the question of Turkey, I wanted to bring up the issue of Kurdistan, and it's because there's these long-standing territorial disputes with Turkey in particular, and there was a massive, even at the time back in the late 1990s, there was a massive genocide or ethnic cleansing, you might say, in the southeast part of the province and of the country. So, where does this leave that conflict as Turkey is sort of, brokering within its different destinies?
Well, I would not use the word ethnic cleansing because it actually sanitizes these words. You should have used the word genocidal behavior or something like that from a personal point, because words convey meanings. Ethnic cleansing, you're cleansing. It's a positive thing to cleanse. In southeast Turkey or northwest Kurdistan, it depends. The glass is half full. It depends on how you'd like to say it. What I want to say about the Kurds is Erdogan was also pursuing a policy of solving the so-called Kurdish question. He wanted to give I don't know what type of autonomy it was. He wanted maybe even to establish a type of confederation which included the Kurds in northern Iraq. That's that would be southern Kurdistan, Rojava, which is western Kurdistan, or Syrian Kurdistan. He wanted to include these. So he wanted the Kurds and Turks to have some type of confederacy. This was part of his policies. He even tried to, he was pushing a peace process forward, and then, what's his name, the preacher in Pennsylvania, Fethullah Gulen, made statements against what was happening. So there was somebody even trying to stop this peace process with the Kurds. I mean, Turkey went through massive changes. Kurdish language was outlawed in Turkey. You couldn't even call yourself a Kurd. You had to say you're a mountain Turk. If you had Kurdish media, you'd go to be court-martialed, a military court. You could even be executed, would put you in jail, life imprisonment. So Turkey's changed a lot in those aspects, from outlawing political activities and cultural expression of the Kurdish people. It changed. And now there's this flip-flop. I mean, now there's a problem. I think one of the things that the Turks are apprehensive about is the project in Syria. There is some type of agreement between the Kurds in Syria and the government in Damascus about a détente where there would be autonomy for them, but within a Syrian state. So maybe the Turks see this as a threat to their project. Maybe they see the American hand as a threat to their territorial integrity. So the issue of the Kurds is on their mind because, Turkey is a member of NATO, but NATO uses maps in Rome of a divided Turkey. And you see that this type of support, and of course, the United States is trying to co-opt, and it's working with. I don't know, it's working with for sure, but it's trying to co-opt the Kurds in Syria, which are affiliated to the Kurds in Turkey. I mean, so there's a lot of things going on. But I want to also point out that many of the Kurds in Syria, in the mainstream. When I mean mainstream, the majority are against the Kurdish government in Iraq, the Kurdistan Regional Government, which is allied to the United States, Israel, Britain. Yeah. So this says a lot of things.
Yeah, it's not a simple question.
Well, it also says that they're independent. They're not proxies. The Kurdistan Regional Government in Erbil in northern Iraq, it works with Turkey. Turkey will work with them. In fact, when it was crossing weapons over and taking Kurds, it didn't allow Syrian Kurds to do this. It let the Peshmerga from the Kurdistan Regional Government come to Turkey and do all these things.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. Our show airs weekly on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm and our podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. Audio from the Patrick Henningsen interview was provided by CFUV's Guerrilla Radio. You can listen to those and other interviews at www.guerrilla-radio.com. I am series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Bye for now.